We keep a big office going. We support an awful lot of management. And we're doing it with a lot of high technology. And we're being treated abusively.
I see word processing centers as kind of a jail sentence. They're nearly plugged in every morning with the machine and chained to their desk. I think that's exploitation.
Sound familiar? It would to the women who entered the office 100 years ago. Even then, women were being promised advancement through technology.
Working conditions of women and their struggles to improve these conditions. Right now, on Alternative Views.
Up until now, at least, the boss could always count on his secretary being loyal, efficient, and smiling. And yet, heavens, we've seen a movie recently called 8 to 5 where the women weren't all quite that happy and loyal. And we have a documentary for you, a tape slide presentation tonight, called Why Aren't We Smiling? About the plight of secretaries. It looks like they've fed up with something and they're starting to try to organize. We have two special guests, too. Alice Embry, here to my right, is a senior secretary at the University of Texas and a member of the 8 to 5 organizing committee. And down on the end is Melissa Heald, who is a historian. She's taught courses on working women at the university and is a resource person for the 8 to 5 organizing committee.
But first, let's turn our attention to the alternative press for two stories on El Salvador. The first is from 1981, about the Reagan-era lies, and the second one from 1994, about the elections in El Salvador.
This week, there were two different analyses published of the Reagan white paper that justifies his government's policy vis-a-vis El Salvador and that claims a justification for why the Reagan administration will send more arms and even military advisors down to El Salvador. The first claim that Reagan makes is that 800 tons of arms were promised to El Salvador by communist bloc countries, particularly Cuba and Russia, and that 2,000 tons of weapons have already been delivered. Well, interestingly, the papers themselves, the captured documents that they found in El Salvador from the guerrillas, only indicate that 10 tons of equipment was actually sent from communist countries that the guerrillas claim that they have received. Secondly, Reagan and Haig have been claiming that Moscow and Havana have been calling the shots. They've been promising giving aid to the rebels in El Salvador and have been indeed directing the activity. Well, again, the documents that were captured themselves indicate that the El Salvador communists who went to Moscow were disappointed because they did not get more promises of aid from the communist countries. They got a very cool reception in Moscow. The head of the El Salvador delegation in the document expressed his unhappiness with the denial of a meeting at the proper level in the Soviet Union and the non-resolution of the requests for help. So the El Salvadorians have been complaining that they haven't been getting support or arms from the Soviet Union. Thirdly, the White Paper and Reagan and Haig claim that the El Salvador revolution is led by a small group of communist dominated subversives in El Salvador, whereas both the white paper as well as the previous intelligence reports that the Carter administration did on the El Salvador situation indicated that there's a broad-based support for the Democratic Front in El Salvador, that far from being just a few communist subversives trying to overthrow a legitimate government, the majority of the country, the church, small business, peasants, and different groups throughout the society are opposed to the current government. So on every single claim that Reagan and Haig have been making and using the white paper to support, the facts of the matter seem very different. Therefore, James Petras, in his analysis in The Nation, concludes that the white paper fails to provide a convincing case for any of its propositions. On the contrary, its evidence is flimsy, circumstantial, or non-existent. The reasoning and logic is slipshod and internally inconsistent. It assumes what needs to be proven. And finally, the very facts that the paper themselves indicate refute the very case that the State Department is attempting to demonstrate.
The July-August edition of NACLA, which specializes in Latin American coverage and analysis, has a very good article on the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and what's happening to them, and also the recent elections in El Salvador. The elections were a big victory for the right-wing Arena Party, which has had been ruling for some time in during the war, and was also it spawned all the death squads, which so brutally murdered so many people. Nonetheless, the people voted for Arena instead of for the guerrillas who turned statesmen and politicians, and who were actually supporting the common people and trying to rid them of all the yoke that the Arena Party and the their ruling class had foisted on them all those years. Well, why was this? Why did the Arena win so big? Well, there are a lot of reasons. It's quite complex. They, for one reason, the Arena and FMLN agreed not to attack each other. Well, Arena did it anyway, but the Dukakis against Bush, the FMLN didn't respond. So the people, all they had was one-sided vision of what was really happening. Arena was able to exploit the cleavages in Salvadorian society between the right and the left. They painted the FMLN as their candidates as terrorists and blamed them for all the problems that had occurred during the war. There was a lot of voting fraud, perhaps as much as 20%, but the Arena won so big that the writers of this article, George Vickers and Jack Spence, say that really wouldn't have made a difference in the outcome of the election. Also keeping people away from the polls were the threats by death squads, the actually killing of some of the FMLN high leaders during this period, and also the patrolling of the army in areas where people were voting. Polls showed that people still were afraid of the death squads and were afraid to speak out or show support. The FMLN didn't make things easy on themselves either. There's one thing to run a war and be guerrillas, it's another thing to be politicians and win elections. And they were really neophytes, and it showed. So that they, not only were they outspent I think 10-1 by Arena and the Christian Democrats, but they really were disorganized among themselves. Now, the FMLN was not a homogeneous, solid group that actually had four or five parties within it, and there was some friction among those, some more conservative and some more leftist. Well, the FMLN, as so many organizations and people do who are populist or progressive or left, when they get into the field of politics, they start becoming conservative. And as so, they lose the real good bite of the what they're wanting to say to the people and something which would attract the people.
But they're afraid of being painted as leftists.
And so, as a result, we've seen this in Mexico and we've seen it in Brazil. And when that happens, well, they just go right down the tube. We also see it in local elections here in Austin. But demographically, the vote was very interesting, too, because in many of the rural areas where the people would benefit from the land reform and self-help programs of the FMLN, the people voted for ARENA. They voted for the people who had been oppressing them all of these years. But on the flip side of that, many of the supporters of the former, quote, terrorists, unquote, the guerrillas, were the upper middle class in El Salvador. Of course, the upper class was solidly for ARENA, but curiously, the upper middle class was. So that it was a very mixed bag, this whole thing of incompetence and the intimidation and complexity of the society of El Salvador. But at least this FMLN did get some experience at politicking and elections. On the other hand, ARENA won by, instead of 400,000 to 500,000 votes, or 200,000 votes, which they got in the previous election, they won by 800,000 votes. So it meant that the Christian Democrats, who were the big losers, those people went over to ARENA. So it looks like it's solidly middle class and upper class against some elements of the people and the upper middle class in El Salvador. Strange election, but who knows what's going to happen next time. It also looks like it may bode ill for the future, because ARENA now is in firm grip of the country, and they may make things worse than they were before.
Now let's turn our attention to the centerpiece of our Alternative Views program and see the documentary, Why Aren't We Smiling?
Why Aren't We Smiling is a production of Community Media Productions. Lorna Rasmussen, one of the women affiliated with New Day Films, got the idea for making the slide tape show after she was impressed with the work that a group in Dayton, Ohio, Working Women, was doing with organizing clerical workers there in Dayton. Some of the important things, I think, to note in the slideshow that we're about to see are, one, clerical work has a long and very significant history, not only in the business world and the structure of the American economy, but in terms of the work that women have done. Clerical work is the work that most women who work do every day, 8 to 5. We also see how essential it is, and we also see the impact of changing technology on that work, what word processing is doing to clerical work and to clerical workers.
I like being a secretary, and I feel that my work is very important. I'm the most important person in my office.
You're taught in business school to be loyal to your boss, and to be loyal to your job, and to be loyal to your company. And never once are you told to be loyal to yourself.
A student would come in, and I'd be in the office, and the student would look around and would say right in my face, "Oh, isn't anybody here?" And I'd think, "Well, sure I am." Or professors who would walk through the hall, and I'd have thousands of papers all spread out, and ask me how come I wasn't smiling.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, when you're laughing, the sun comes shining through.
But when a secretary crying, and a smile, it's just expected. A smile is the required uniform of an office worker. But today, many of us are asking ourselves, what do I have to smile about? And that's a good question. Office workers do have a lot of legitimate complaints. Low pay, increasingly dull and mechanical work, racial discrimination, sexual discrimination, little or no chance of job advancement, sexual harassment. The list goes on and on. What it all adds up to is a lack of respect for us and the work that we do. It wasn't always this way. Little more than a century ago, office work was a respected profession, and office workers received good pay and social status. But at that time, all clericals were men. In those small personal offices, a young clerk strongly identified with the manager, and many could expect to rise to good positions in the business. They were proud to be gentlemen working for gentlemen, and their pay and working conditions put them in a class above the common laborer. In the 1850s, middle-class women began to look for jobs in the office. They felt its clean and socially acceptable environment would be more suitable to their status than factory or domestic work, but no one would hire them. It took the Civil War to get women into the office. With most young men in the army, the government was faced with a shortage of clerks, and so opened its doors to women. But while they were in, they were still not welcome. Robert McClellan, Secretary of the Interior, stated,
"There is such an obvious impropriety in mixing the sexes within the walls of a public office that I am determined to arrest the practice."
With the end of the Civil War, these objections were soon forgotten. Peace and a tremendous increase in production created a need for more and more office workers. There were simply not enough trained men available, and business found it needed women in order to expand. Women were now welcome, especially since they were willing to work for half the pay of men. As women entered the office, the nature of the job changed dramatically. Office work was no longer the promising career it had once been. It was now women's work, with accompanying low pay and social status. Today, 80 years later, our position as clerical workers remains the same, or worse.
It makes me angry, especially when I'm working so hard during the day, just frantic, trying to get everything done that people want me to get done. And I want to get them done because my job is important to me. It would just be nice if I knew that all the extra hours that I put in, I was going to be paid for.
We're just simply office workers. And that's no small thing because we keep a big office going. We support an awful lot of management. And we're doing it with a lot of high technology. And we're being treated abusively.
I think that because secretarial work has been so undervalued monetarily, as well as the view that we have of it as being less important than what men do, that women feel like they must get away from that in order to have any kind of a self-esteem. In fact, I'm working with a couple of women that became computer operators. And it sounds, you know, like a really glamorous job too. And they left the secretarial field as GS-4s in 1974. And they were promised that they would go to a GS-5, and then from a 5 they could compete for a 7 and a 9 and 11. Really sounded great. Those women are still GS-5s after 5 years. What they're doing basically is tearing computer products off of the printer. That's much less challenging than what they had as stenographers 5 years ago. They had much more interesting work. They're on shift work. They have to work in a cold computer room. You know, for one grade, I think that's exploitation.
Sound familiar? It would to the women who entered the office 100 years ago. Even then, women were being promised advancement through technology. Business was aware that men were suspicious of their female competitors. To calm their fears, management encouraged women to take on an entirely new task in the office: operating business machines. Women seized typing as a golden opportunity to get a job, and men said, "Well, of course they can play the piano. It's not surprising they can type." Increasingly, decision-making was removed from the jobs women did. The typing pool, a new development in the 1920s, created an even greater distinction between routine manual tasks and managerial work. Two separate job hierarchies emerged, one for men leading up through the layers of management, and one for women leading nowhere. typing pool of the 20s has been replaced by the word processing center of the 80s. Technology, once again making the office ever more efficient and profitable. But how do the women who operate these machines feel?
These god-awful word processing machines that were supposed to be so innovative and turn the office around have just about beat me to death. But no one seems to understand that. They seem to call it an automatic typewriter. And it only becomes automatic when I have done a great deal of work.
I see word processing centers as kind of a jail sentence. They're nearly plugged in every morning with the machine and chained to their desk. And they don't have the kind of freedom that they had in the past of talking to people in the office or having interaction with even each other. They're in these little glass cages. They can see the other woman over here, but they can't talk to them, and they just sit there and type all day long.
She's a highly specialized key, component of operational unity, a fine and sensitive mechanism to serve the office community.
While technology limited most women to low-paid manual office jobs, it has opened the door to a whole new group of women. The government may have encouraged black women to enter the office, but business was firm in keeping them out. Black women faced the same discrimination that white women had experienced nearly a century before. But with the development of the computer after the Second World War, large numbers of new clerical workers were needed. That need and a changed social climate made business turn to black women.
In 1955, times were changing, and they had to have their little token blacks. That's what I was.
Did the civil rights movement at that time, did that encourage more women, and particularly blacks, to try to get into the office, or were you still?
I think there
much?
Was a new wave, yes. A lot of people tried to better their conditions. A lot of women who had been prevented from working in offices had been maids, cooks, waitresses, you name it. It offered a chance to work in dignity.
Between 1960 and 1967, the number of non-white clerical workers increased by 77%. This is compared to a 23% increase in white workers. But getting into the office did not mean an end to discrimination.
We were not being paid fairly, and work assignments weren't given fairly. The reality was that women and blacks were not paid the same as men and whites for the same job.
The civil rights movement did much to raise the consciousness of blacks and working women, and was instrumental in passing reform legislation. But the impact of all of this on the office has been minimal. In spite of the fact that clerical work is the fastest growing sector of the workforce, little has changed since women first entered the office more than a century ago.
I'm a working woman, they call me 9 to 5. What that means is I work full time, trying to survive. First I take care of boss's business, and then I go home and take care of mine. Oh, I'm a working. File a lot, smile a lot, yes sir, have a good day. On my seat, deadline did not delay. I got phone-itis in spite of it, they put in an extra line. I gotta file faster, type faster, whiteout is clogging my mind. And without me, the boss would be totally at a loss. I'd like some respect to be reflected in the check. And I'm not your girl, and you know it. At home, I'm a woman, and I'm a poet. I'm skilled at my job, so don't abuse it. There's power in numbers, and working women are gonna use it.
Power and numbers. This, too, is part of working women's history. From the beginning, we have been part of a movement to improve working conditions and earn a living wage. Some of the earliest unions were clerical unions. Federal legislation in the 1930s gave legal sanction and respectability to unions. As a result, many clerical workers organized into the shops of the CIO and AF of L. Despite this optimistic start, most clerical workers were not to gain union representation. The world was changing in the 1970s, and women were beginning to think differently about themselves and their work. Once again, clerical organizing became a real possibility.
The office workers movement of today grows directly from the ideas of women's equality and from the changed economic conditions of women. You had a tremendous recession, you had wide-scale layoffs of men in blue-collar jobs, so that the trend was to find women in jobs where their income was necessary to the family's livelihood, not just secondary.
When you go home with your paycheck, you have to pay the same amount for groceries and for rent as the person who's getting paid more. And it's your responsibility to keep a job, be able to pay your bills, so you should try to do something about the conditions you're working under.
I think we have to look at our jobs now as a lot of other skilled labor jobs are looked at. And if we're going to have any respect, and if we're going to be paid anything at all to earn a living, we're going to have to stand up and demand this. And for myself, I'm all for organizing.
The opposition that we face, these huge companies, they're very well organized. They have entire personnel departments in every single company. They have personnel associations. They have the Chamber of Commerce. So that when they say to employees, couldn't you come to us as an individual? Why did you have to take this nasty step of organizing? It's just downright hypocritical. We have to have some power on our side, and that power is the strength of our numbers and the fact that we're right in what we're asking for.
How are women putting this power to use? One of the newest ways is working women's organizations, which clerical workers themselves are forming across the country.
It's important to me to be a member of Dayton Women Working because of the knowledge that I have gained about my rights, about the agencies, about the options that are available. I know that I'm not alone and that there are other women out there trying to make the same changes on their jobs that I am.
I find it very helpful to hear someone else express my thought. And I could just sit there and say, by God, that's just how I feel.
Through meetings and public forums, working women's organizations educate clerical workers to their rights and encourage them to use the available laws. They also target industries with large clerical staffs and investigate their labor practices. These groups are always looking for new ways to help themselves and other working women.
We had been active for about 2 years in 9 to 5, and a number of people would come to us with particular problems at their own workplace, and we would help them go through a series of steps to resolve those problems with their boss. Several groups of people had gone through those steps, came down to a flat note, and didn't know where to go from there. It was at that point that we decided that we needed to make use of the law, and that law was the National Labor Relations Act. Not only does it guarantee people the right to organize, but it says that if you can convince a majority of people at your workplace to act as a group, then your employer is obligated by law to meet with you and to write up a contract. That was the problem we were having. We couldn't get the employers to agree to meet with us. They'd simply say, do you know what we do with these petitions? We just throw them right in the trash. And people just didn't know where to go from there. Little did they know that what it meant to unionize was that you simply formalized the fact that the majority of people wanted to act as a group, meet with the employer, and resolve the problems. So we started the very first autonomous local for women office workers, Local 925. And that hasn't created any kind of problem at all for members of 9 to 5 who don't think that unionizing is the road that they want to go. The two organizations are able to work side by side because they have similar concerns but utilize different avenues to bring about change. And those different ways of bringing about change are completely compatible.
You've got to go down.
Women are finding they need the legal clout of belonging to a union. Unions are an important option for women to examine, because with few exceptions, little is guaranteed to working people by law.
There is no guarantee that you be given a promotion opportunity, or that they not fire you, or that they lay you off out of seniority, or that you get a raise at all, or they can't cut your pay. Bosses can do virtually anything they like. So the only way to get it guaranteed to you is with a contract. Even though your pay goes up and, you know, you get a pension and these things. Really, the most important thing is that you have a way to handle any problem that comes up, and they are obliged to sit down with you as equals across a bargaining table and discuss it.
Betty Carroll worked for years in non-union jobs. Now a vice president of Local 1138 of the American Federation of Government Employees, she is one woman who understands the value of a union.
All those years that I didn't work without a union, I was constantly in fear of being fired. I would go to work when I was sick, and I would go to work when I was just exhausted. And I don't want to go through those experiences again. And if you don't remain organized and have some kind of a union, that's what could happen to you.
There are advantages and disadvantages to both unions and working women's organizations. But improvements in our working conditions will only come if we raise our voices together. And it is happening now across the whole country.
There is definitely a change, and Dayton Women Working is proof of that. Cleveland Women Working is proof of that. 9 to 5 in Boston, women employed. I could go on, and the demand is growing. Women in Atlanta call and say, "How did you get started? We need something like this down here." And it's not all just young women. It's women who have been secretaries for years. It's been their career, and they see it as a career. I think that's something else that we need. Women need to see being a secretary as a career. If we can get the pay, if we can get the respect, it could be a good career.
You know, women want more determined than they ever have. Women walk with a stronger stride than they ever did before. Take a look, sisters and brothers, 'cause you're gonna find you've got another kind of woman who will ask a lot and give a lot and live a whole lot more. My friend, you and I have come a long way, and we're gonna go farther still. For the more I learn about myself and my world, you know, the more both of us will. All the ancient fears are coming out now, and I'm getting them under control. For I realize until I love myself, nothing else is gonna make me whole. You know, women walk more determined than they ever have. Women walk with a stronger stride than they ever did before. Take a look, sisters and brothers, 'cause you're gonna find you've got another kind of woman who will ask a lot and give a lot and live a whole lot more.
Since World War I, really, women have been moving into the workplace in ever-increasing numbers every year, especially married women, and as we've seen, especially since 1950, older women, especially women with children. And another trend that I think the new census is going to bring out is the fact that most of the women who work, and increasingly many of them, have single-parent responsibilities that we can no longer hold with the popular idea that women work for pin money, that women work to supplement the family income in sort of non-essential ways. Women work because they have to. Their income is up to about a third of the total family income, and without that critical one-third, many families, especially middle-class families, would not be able to buy a certain kind of lifestyle that they want.
The woman who's in a really hard position, though, is the woman who's a sole supporter, like
right.
like you're talking about. I think the statistics are 1/3 of working women are sole supporters of their families.
Absolutely. That's one of my favorite lines in the whole slideshow, when the woman says, you know, I go and do the boss's work all day, and then I go home and do my work at night. She has two jobs. She's a homemaker and she's a worker.
What role do you think the women's liberation movement of the 60s and the early 1970s has played in raising the consciousness of women, both in terms of taking pride in their work and in terms of organizing and making demands that previously they hadn't made?
Alice?
Well, I think it's been critical. There were rising expectations that came out of the women's liberation movement. There was certainly a rising consciousness about the value of women's work. One of the hardest things, I think, about being a clerical worker is that you feel that your work is undervalued. It's also underpaid, and that's an indication of its undervalue in the society. But that is so traditional for women. They find that what they do traditionally is undervalued in this society, whether they're homemakers or whether they're working for wages.
What were some of the first steps that women took to try to deal with these problems in terms of organizing in the workplace and raising consciousness of their fellow workers, male and female?
Workplace committees. I remember some in New York City, especially in the publishing industry, where women editors were receiving just, you know, pitiful wages and doing work that that mostly male superiors, you know, were getting paid twice as much for. And I think that is the beginning stages, you know, workplace committees where women get together and they talk about their common problems, and they realize that no, they aren't just, you know, individuals, you know, facing this vast array of problems, that they have, you know, they have a lot to share with each other, and there's a sense of pride that does develop. And I think in terms of organizing strategies, now we're seeing a lot of union activity. Women are finding that it's important to form unions with other employees to get what they want. There are a lot of advantages to union organizing.
What are some of these things? I understand there's an organization called Working Women, which has groups around the country.
Right. That's another example of how women are beginning to make a difference in their workplace, but also an example of the impact of the feminist movement on women who work in general. The people who started Working Women very early on tapped into other feminist organizations, and I'm specifically thinking of NOW and the Women's Political Caucus and the even ERA America. And by working with other groups, they've become not only effective in starting organizing efforts in other cities, because they can go to cities and there's a, you know, some sort of feminist coalition already at work and tap into that. But Working Women just recently was awarded a $200,000 grant by the Fund for the Improvement of Post-Secondary Education to do Working Women History projects in 10 major cities. And to get that kind of money is a real step forward. And the work that they do, collecting the history and making it known to working women, is going to do a lot, I think, to make women, especially clerical workers, aware of the fact that there are other women out there, that there are resources, and that they can make a difference and a change in their workplace.
How widespread are these organizing efforts?
Yes, I think it's very widespread. And this year, I think we've seen a lot of activity and a lot of national media attention because of the movie 9 to 5 and the documentary The Wilmar 8, because of the slideshow. One thing I want to talk about, Ed, is that we aren't just talking about office workers who are women. There are 13 million office and clerical workers in the United States, and 80% of them are women. So we certainly are talking about a job category where the majority
right.
of workers are women. But male office workers face the same problems in terms of low esteem, low pay, lack of benefits, all of those kind of things. And the 8-to-5 organizing committee is reaching out to all office workers and clerical workers. At the university, I think there are 2,000 clerical workers and 1,700 are women.
Are they organizing? Are they starting to organize?
Well, we're hoping. We have high hopes. We think there are a lot of issues on this campus that we need to talk about. Low pay is an obvious one. Lack of promotional and advancement opportunities is another one. And I think child care. We're talking about a situation where about 50% of working women have children that they need to care for. And in, I think if we did a survey, I don't think the statistics exist on this campus yet, but we would find there is a crying need for child care at the University of Texas, and it is something that an institution with this wealth should subsidize, and I think it's a responsibility as an employer for the University of Texas to set up child care centers on campus.
Having worked now 8 years in the University of Texas, I can attest to the incredible discrepancies between salaries for secretarial people and professors. Often the secretaries run the departments. Without them, the whole ball game would collapse, and they are getting paid often much less than even assistant professors or instructors. So it's certainly an obvious example, secretaries here in the university and the heroic and often tremendous work that they do, and yet they're on a quite low pay scale. Have there been some efforts in the university to raise secretarial pay scale or clerical workers? There's been some discussion of this in the state legislature.
Yeah, I think one thing we need to recognize here is the work of the University Employees Union in looking out for all employees across job categories at the University of Texas. And due to extensive lobbying at the legislature, we did get a $50 across the board increase, which was very significant because it was across the board. It did help people at the low end of the pay scale. And there is a current effort to lobby for $150 in September and another $150 the following September. And that's, I think, critically important for people to be unified around that demand. So we're trying to cooperate with those efforts. It's a problem that faces all UT employees, all UT staff. It's not just a clerical and office work problem.
What kind of response do you get from the working women here at clericals when you approach them, talk to them about unions and all? Considering that it seems to me that there's such an intense kind of one-on-one situation with the secretary and her boss, a tremendous amount of loyalty and quite intimate relationship.
Yeah.
That it's difficult to break down to form something of a more cooperative or collective nature.
Yeah, I think, frankly, there are a lot of problems. I think most secretaries would tell you that, you know, they're only here temporarily until something better comes along, until their husband gets a PhD, until they get their master's, or, you know, something on that level, until things change. When, like Melissa points out, in reality, they're where most working women are. That's the facts, you know. Clerical work is what most working women are doing.
Isn't it also the case that the development of technologies are going to make more and more clerical work in the future? I mean, we've seen statistics, some of which are mentioned in this tape, about the transition from a blue-collar industrial workforce to a white-collar clerical one. What is the role of technology here? Isn't it ambivalent? On one hand, it creates new jobs with computers, word processors, etc. But doesn't it also sort of de-skill some sorts of labor? What would you want to comment on?
Dehumanize them.
And dehumanize.
I think it may work in favor of current organizing efforts simply because when a person sits in front of a computer terminal all day long processing or managing very complex machines and is not having that kind of personal interaction that you've talked about a minute ago, that's going to work for people coming together collectively to unionize or to organize at some level. On the other hand, the paperless office, you know, where there's just these sort of banks of machines and storage systems for tapes, and one or two, you know, sort of cold temperatures and one or two people guarding and programming and working this equipment, has a very high tech, very, you know, very unhuman aspect to it, and it makes those people simply technicians. And what then? It's you know, it could go either way. It's hard to tell.
I've read some studies of these IBM total office apparatuses where you have literally a computerized office, and they have them now, mm-hmm. which to some extent would eliminate secretarial, clerical skills and would create a market for technicians more right. in the workplace.
Thousands and thousands of people are going to lose their jobs. And where are these women going to go? If clerical work is the work most women do, what's going to happen then?
Well, I think one thing, and we see it here right now, is that as this high technology comes into the office, secretaries are being asked to run these machines, usually with very inadequate training. Mm-hmm. You know, by the way, then you turn it on here and, you know, you do this. I mean, it's you do not receive the kind of training that you need to make that job easy. And you don't receive the pay that job category is supposed to give. I mean, for instance, a MAG card operator is supposed to earn more than a senior secretary, but senior secretaries that do MAG card work don't receive higher pay.
I've noticed this here in the University of Texas. There's been more and more complex technology brought into the offices of most departments that the secretaries are forced. The burden of running these machines is on them, but yet you're right, they haven't gotten a pay raise that would be commensurate with these added responsibilities. This would seem to be an issue that could be successfully organized around, that if you're going to be technicians as well as traditional mm-hmm. secretaries, that you should be paid more.
I agree.
Okay. Well, gee, you're going to have to go back here in a minute
to work.
To your 8-to-5 job, aren't you? We've
That's
kept
right.
you about as long as we can. That's one of the problems. But thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I see we have time for some more news stories.
Well, here's another indication of what we could have if the corporations would let us. There are three inventors, this once again from right-wing sources, three inventors, two in DeSoto, Missouri, and one in Big Spring, Texas, that have developed fuel-saving devices that can save, well, anywhere from 50, you can get anywhere from 50 to 200 miles a gallon on your car. Jimmy Leffler of Big Spring recently signed a contract with International Harvester to put in motion the production of his device, a gas-saving device that can double the mileage of the normal car. He says anywhere from 60 to 80 miles per gallon. And then it's very, very simple. He says you just put it in your air cleaner and that's it. Now, the people in Missouri, David Williams and Will Crane, say they run cars on gasoline vapors. They're getting 50 miles a gallon on their car now and should be getting 100 miles per gallon with refinements. This is not new, though. Back in 1936 and 1937, the Pogue carburetor was manufactured in Canada, and it got that 200 miles per gallon. The Ford Motor Company tested the device, also got 200 miles per gallon, but we never saw the carburetor. And in 1977, it was kind of reworked or reintroduced. I think a fellow out in El Paso, I remember in the media, talked about it. And Shell Oil Company offered him $2 million for the rights to it. And of course, he said, I'm not going to sell it to them for $2 million. It'll never hit the market. But this is what has happened in the past. And so these two Missouri inventors saying they're not going to let the automobile manufacturers get a hold on it because they'll just repress it. So they're forming their own corporation to try to do this. So hang on to your gas guzzlers, folks. They, like the Confederate dollar, may rise again.
Well, we'll have to keep a close eye on that because this has been one of the scandals of American technology, that all these devices to give better gas mileage have been suppressed. Earlier, it was Detroit that did it, interestingly enough, Frank. It was the automobile industry that bought up the patents to all of these devices, claiming they were going to put them on the cars, and they didn't. Whereas now it's the oil corporations who, of course, have the excess profit, so they can spend any amount of money buying up these sorts of patents because it's really in their interest now.
Well, here's something, talking about women's problems and abortion and all. We might use this as our bedtime story. It's a dialogue which was made by a man named Richard Cohen, published in the Washington Post back in November of last year, which flushes out the abortion situation pretty well. It's a dialogue between a liberal himself, I guess, the writer, and a senator, Senator Righteous. And he says, "Senator, can you tell us your position on abortion, please?"
"I'm against it. It's murder. It's vile and evil and immoral and un-American, and I favor legislation to outlaw it."
"In all cases, Senator?"
"No. No, the only exceptions would be rape or incest, and if the life of the mother was endangered."
"Why, Senator?"
"Why what?"
"Well, if abortion is murder, why make an exception for rape or incest?"
"Well, because..."
"Well, don't you think that the fetus produced by rape is a human life? Is it the fault of the fetus that it was produced by rape?"
"Well, no, but..."
"Well, then, why would you allow that type of abortion when you wouldn't allow abortion under normal circumstances?"
"Well, now, hold on, son, hold on. Rape is a dastardly act. It's a crime against womanhood. It would be terrible if the woman had to live with the results of a criminal act, a profane intrusion against her womanhood."
"Well, yes, thank you, Senator, but is the human life produced by rape less worthy than the human life produced by happy and occasional blissful matrimony?"
Well, no.
"And if it's not, then are we really talking about just saving human life? We're talking about something else, aren't we, Senator? Maybe the feelings of the mother."
"Well, I wouldn't put it that way."
"But one kind can be aborted and the other cannot. Isn't abortion always murder?"
"Well, now, son, I resent..."
"Well, let's go on, Senator. How about incest? Why should abortion be permitted if the fetus was conceived as a result of incest?"
"Well, incest is an abomination. It's a sin, a heinous sin."
"Well, yes, Senator, but it's not the baby who sinned."
"No, no, but..."
"And if the baby is innocent, why kill it? Is it not a life like any other life?"
"Well, yes, but..."
"Is the baby any different from the one conceived in a drunken grope in the back of a car?"
Well, now...
"Is it any different from the one conceived by a teenage girl who's not yet prepared for... to be a mother, not even emotionally prepared to be pregnant?"
"Well, now, slow down, son, slow down. Well, yes, it is different. A woman who's been raped is a victim of a crime. A woman who otherwise conceived a fetus has done the deed herself."
"So she ought to live with the consequences?"
"Right."
"She ought to be punished for what she's done?"
"Right, right. Well, wait a minute. No, it's not that simple."
"So then we're making value judgments that have nothing at all to do with the sanctity of life. It has to do instead with the concepts of punishment and responsibility."
Well, sort of, yes.
"And you want the government to establish those values for all people under all circumstances?"
"Well, someone has to do it."
"Well, why not the woman?"
"Well, some of them are for abortion on demand."
"Well, yes, but they are also making value judgments. You would permit abortion under some circumstances. So would they. Just under more circumstances."
"They don't consider it murder."
"You do?"
"Correct."
"You believe in capital punishment?"
"Absolutely."
"And you believe abortion is murder?"
"Absolutely."
"Then the woman who has an abortion and the doctor who performs it should be executed?"
Why?
"Well, you just said it's murder."
"You liberals think you're cute."
"No, Senator. Just confused." "Good night."
"I'm a working woman. They call me 9 to 5. What that means is I work full time, trying to survive. First I take care of boss's business, and then I go home and take care of mine. Oh, I'm a working woman, and they call me 9 to 5.
And if we're going to have any respect, and if we're going to be paid anything at all to earn a living, we're going to have to stand up and demand this. And for myself, I'm all for organizing.
The opposition that we face, these huge companies, they're very well organized.
She's a highly specialized bee, component of operational unity. A fine and sensitive mechanism to serve the office community.
Improvements in our working conditions will only come if we raise our voices together. And it is happening now across the whole country.
Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope.